The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. VDH, Victor Davis Hanson, friend of the show, writing in National Review. Emeritus Barack Obama now and then ventures out to go through the motions of an enfeebled defense for what is becoming an increasingly discredited administration. But his heart isn't in it. His mind is elsewhere. His cause is no longer social activism and community organizing, as if it ever was, means to an end. But lucre and the perceived well-earned good life. The arc of his moralizing universe is long, but for the anointed like him, it apparently bends toward the just deserts of riches and material bounty. And that says nothing of its extension to Michelle Obama, recently feted by the very production company they set up to house $50 million in Netflix money. Feted what she was a documentary about her book tour. Not exactly, the end of the tour, David Foster Wallace, when we're talking about films about book tours. But Matt Maher takes it one step further. Oh, goodness. Obama should apologize to Trump. Apologies. Perish the thought. Matt Maher, president at OpportunityOhio.org, contributor to Spectator USA, joins us now. Matt, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Why should an administration that never suffered even the scent of scandal apologize to President Trump?
Because they've done wrong. It's clear they've done wrong. And if Barack Obama is the man he says he is, and if Michelle Obama's "when they go low, we go high" has any merit to it, then they should step up to the plate and say, look, our administration, we were wrong. We put you and, more importantly, all those people that had to go in front of the House or Senate committees, had to be deposed, went in front of the special counsel, had to spend millions of dollars on lawyers, had their lives disrupted. Those people deserve an apology as much or more than Donald Trump. That's politics, and politics ain't beanball, we know. But those people didn't sign up to have their lives thrown into the wind, including General Flynn, because Barack Obama and his administration decided to spy on the administration based upon the flimsy of flimsy information, and they were wrong. So man up and say you're sorry.
Do you expect that President Obama will ever be cornered into saying anything on the topic? He clearly is taking the, hear no evil route thus far.
Well, look, if he happens to venture out of the cocoon that is the mainstream media, yeah, I think there are people like Catherine Herridge over at CBS News. There are some good reporters at Fox News who would ask him the tough questions. But no, of course not. I don't think any mainstream media person would dare ask him the tough questions about the July or January 5th meeting in the Oval Office, right? About what did he know and when did he know it? And that's unfortunate, because our system demands and needs accountability and transparency for us to make sure that our liberties and freedoms are always protected.
It's been said by many now, it's almost become a Republican talking point, but so I want you to address it, that President Obama, based on what we're learning, the Obama administration, not just him, but his administration, ended a two-plus century tradition of the peaceful transfer of power. Is that too strong a statement, or do you find that to be accurate? And if you do find it to be accurate, explain it. Why is that so? Why did this surveillance, if you accept that it began in good faith, just out of concern for making sure national secrets were secure, why would this be violence in a sense rather than a peaceful transfer of power?
Well, look, because you got to keep in mind what the timeline is, right? And where all this came from, right? Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democrat National Committee paid for a foreign national to work with other foreign nationals to essentially dig up dirt and influence the election. They then went the next step further, the Obama administration did, right, by essentially weaponizing that. In that January 5th meeting is so critical because he asked everybody else to leave except the three people that were going to be staying on after the inauguration occurred. And the whole intent of those three people was to continue to use this information to undermine the Trump administration and to do harm to the Trump administration. That disrupts the peaceful transition of power where when you lose, you'll walk away, take your marbles with you, and that's the way the game is played. In this situation, the Obama, he was his meeting in the Oval Office with those three remaining people who would be holdovers into the Trump administration. They weaponized that information and then try to use it to do the stuff what they then did for the next 3 years that absolutely disrupted the Trump administration's ability to govern, created mass amounts of disruption in American society, and created an even greater strain in terms of our civic war we're now under. And so I think it is irresponsible, and it was wrong to have done, and he should man up and apologize for it.
When we come back with Matt Maher, I want to ask if the personnel consulting on the D.C. COVID-19 response, if they're not a microcosm of everything that was wrong in the two administrations preceding Trump's. More with Matt Maher, president at OpportunityOhio.org and contributor to Spectator USA right after this.
And keep your hands to yourself.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. And we played this clip yesterday in our discussion about reopening the schools in the fall. This is Michael Chertoff, the former secretary for the Department of Homeland Security under President George W. Bush, on Face the Nation over the weekend, suggesting what he is advising the mayor of D.C. when it comes to school reopening.
Well, the idea is, at least in stage one, to have distance learning, have it be done remotely. But then over the next two stages, which mean that we would have basically reduced the outbreak to isolated outbreaks, during the next period of time, we would slowly begin to bring students in. Those entering transitional grades or needing extra instruction would come in first. We'd make sure to maintain distancing in classrooms to keep the collection of people in a particular classroom below a certain number, like 10, to make sure the same youngsters were together throughout the day so you don't have a lot of people mixing with other groups.
Collaborating on the reopen plan in D.C., Susan Rice, former NSA to President Obama and pathological liar, as we know, on everything from Benghazi to the Flynn surveillance. Eddie Scari writing in WashingtonExaminer.com, D.C.'s lockdown is miserable, and it's what Democrats want for the whole country. And he talks about them being on the precipice of entering the phase one of their reopening, even as the mayor announced yesterday for the first time in a couple of months, no COVID-19 related death, not a one, on the previous day. For more on this, we return back to our friend Matt Maher, president at OpportunityOhio.org and contributor to Spectator USA. A Spectator piece you wrote about Michael Chertoff in particular in the context of his consultation with D.C. because you work for Chertoff. So I wonder what you have to say about the unholy alliance of Chertoff and Rice when it comes to D.C. consultation.
Yeah, look, you know, I was in the secretary's office with the secretary. He's a very smart man, but look, he is a trained lawyer, former judge. He's not an epidemiologist. He's not a scientist. So, you know, his opinion should carry no more weight than your or my opinion. In this situation, the science indicates reopening schools because kids are not at risk of this very as much. They're at risk as much as they are from the flu, right? They're just not getting
Not even.
So there have been more flu deaths in America this year than there have among those under 18 than there have been from the virus. And moreover, focus on protecting the staff and the teachers, like Mitch Daniels at Purdue University said that that's going to be their focus when they reopen. But look, you know, Michael Chertoff, Susan Rice, they are part of that elite bubble of D.C. that are multimillionaires. They don't have to worry about things like, you know, paying the bills, finding childcare when their kids are at home and they've just got to put food on the table. They are so far removed from the Main Street America, Main Street Washington, D.C., you know, the people that, you know, they have pushed further to the edges as they've gentrified more and more of the district over the last 20 years, right? those people need to work. Their kids need to be in school. And we just need to make sure we protect teachers and staff who are at risk because they're obese, they have respiratory issues, they have diabetes. Protect them, but let's get our kids back in school. The mental health of these kids needs to be among their peers, enjoying learning. And distance learning in this system that we've created in the last 2 months is an utter failure. Kids aren't learning. It's not doing them any good. And so we're going to stunt the learning of these kids that are already kind of, you know, have a strike against them because they're in bad schools. They come from single parent families where there's not the resources that they need to succeed. So his idea, I don't know where he got it from, but, you know, look, he's the lawyer just like, you know, anybody else. So I say, you know, nice idea, but boy, the science doesn't seem to indicate that, neither does common sense.
Well, right. And it's also just so myopic, you know, so many smart people, and I can see the point, he's a smart guy, but just so myopic. How can you only look at one aspect of this when you must realize, if you're paying even passing attention, how layered and complicated this is? There was a piece by Kay Himowitz recently in City Journal talking about human beings as and human social networks. You know, it's not just viruses that are social. In fact, there's a lot of research that shows, for example, a divorce within your social circle makes you more likely to get divorced. The sort of the shared behavior perspective that happens within various human networks. And so, and nobody is even considering, as you were sort of intimating, but this distance learning, the staggered days, the staggered classrooms, the one group of students stays with one group of students and one instructor and they move around, all of these suggestions to fundamentally alter the way that we educate kids. It's not asking, is this the best way to educate kids? It's not asking, is this the best? Are we making sure we're being thoughtful about their intellectual development as well as their social and emotional development? I don't hear people asking those questions, or much less answering. Well, nobody's asking them, so nobody's answering. But suggesting, you know, we've thought about this and we're going to take these steps consistent with wanting to make sure that we're doing the best we can in the circumstances for the development across all of those planes.
No, yeah, that's exactly right. And you're seeing this bubble up across communities, right? You're seeing increased mental health issues among kids, right? I see with my own kids where, you know, they're dying to just play with their friends. They're dying to be back in school. Look, when you have a 9-year-old boy saying, "Dad, I really wish I could go back to school," you know that that's a problem. No 9-year-old boy normally wants to ever be in school, right?
Right.
But he's so desperate to be around his friends and be back to normal, be out at recess. And I say, look, the data shows that there's low risk to him and his friends of even if they catch it, it's going to be like the flu or less. Then again, let's protect those teachers and staff that might be at risk. And I say, great, states, we did all this regulatory reform to allow doctors to cross state lines and all these other things that allowed us to respond. Here's yet another one. Can we get rid of the teachers union restrictions that prevent someone like me? You know, I've got my law degree. I've written 3 books. I've taught it at the university level. I'll be happy to pop in there and teach a high school history, civics, and other courses. Let me in without having to go get some teacher's degree that, by the way, is probably worthless and adds no value to the ability to impact the classroom. Let's make it so people like me can go in there, help these kids while the teachers that are at risk can't teach, but they can assist on the outside side of the fence, right? They can be outside the building, but assisting those replacement teachers during the period of time that they can't teach. Let's get our kids back into school and get to normal, man. I mean, we're getting to a sense where we have so devastated the economy. We're devastating the mental health of everybody, including our kids. And the idea here that we're just going to say, oh, let's have phase 1, 2, and 3, and then we're going to put in, you know, these kids at this time and only 10 at a time, and then we're going to make sure they can't do X, Y, and Z. I mean, my goodness, the data doesn't support that kind of a response.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
The regimentation of a technocratic state, it's very dangerous, actually. Matt Mayer, president of OpportunityOhio.org, contributor to Spectator USA. Matt, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Take care. You've been
by the flag. The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.